Okay, so you're a producer and an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Is it hard to juggle both?
Sometimes. But I'm kind of used to it. I guess in indie theater we do so many things all at once. So I'm also a playwright. I do graphic design. You kind of, when you're working at this in this community, you sort of learn to juggle a lot of different tasks all at mm-hmm. once. But it's a lot of work. In this company, though, I've got a lot of help.
It's a great team.
Yeah, it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you give me a definition of indie theater? Because not everybody is aware of what's happening.
Indie theater is New York theater that is not designated as Broadway or off Broadway. Mm-hmm. It's an area where we can develop new works, where playwrights who are just emerging can see their work done and see it fully realized, but see it fully realized very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We also work on a much lower end budget wise. Mm-hmm. So you know, when you're looking at an off Broadway contract, because like we're talking about getting it, you know, $100,000, mm-hmm. and here our budgets are all under about $35,000. And that includes renting space as well. Most mm-hmm. indie companies don't have their own space, so we rent others, like mm-hmm. I can go and hire it.
It's a nice space, though, and I like the neighborhood.
It's a great place. It's also, indie theater is also a place where non-union actors and very young actors can work with professionals and learn from them and, you know, on the job
mm-hmm.
and in a very short period of time.
And the premiere and everything will be right here for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we open here April 1st.
Maria, I love it.
It's a really small space, but what are the benefits of playing in front of a small audience?
The New Ohio is a very flexible space. It's just very open. But it's a nice, intimate size. For a show like this, it's great because the audience gets really, it's very close
mm-hmm.
to the action. And the way Jones staged it, it really feels like it's coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's great. And a lot of theaters downtown are like this, where you really feel that you're a part of things. That the action of the play, the terror and everything, is not behind glass. In a way,
mm-hmm.
it's really, yeah. It becomes very personal.
I got a little bit of glimpse of what's happening, and it's scarier than I thought, and I didn't even see that much, but the sound, the lighting, everything works so well together.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see it all come together.
Mm-hmm. And who worked on the decorations?
We have a whole design team. Our set designer
Six
is not
designers.
Here. Yeah.
But Tom Lee is the set designer,
mm-hmm.
and he designed the set for the production last summer up in Maine, and then came and working with that show was running in rep with the production of Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
So the set design and they were happening on the same set. So the set design needed to take into account the needs of both productions, and coming here and Joan can maybe speak to this more, they were able to take many of the ideas that we had for that set and
mm-hmm.
translate them both for this space, but also solely for the needs of this play, mm-hmm. which is nice.
Yeah.
So these are new decorations, not the ones from the last year.
Right,
yeah.
No, it's all new.
Completely
yeah.
new. Some of the costumes have been...
Mm-hmm.
Some of the costumes are...
Like the summer was a prototype, turns out,
mm-hmm.
for the costume designer in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So some of the costumes are the same but better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just, tweaked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you already talked to.
So talk to these
fix.
Guys.
But I want to see. You told us how the idea was born.
Mm-hmm.
And, why zombies? Why do you think they're so popular in
zombies? Well, yeah, it's funny. First of all, I would have thought if I were going to write some kind of supernatural monster adaptation of a classical play, it would have been vampires, because like I've never been like a big zombie fan. But then when I had this idea, the idea was what it was. It was very clear that it was going to be this zombie idea. And so because of that, I've sought out an education in zombie lore from, you know, the earliest origins with like the Haitian Boudon kind of zombie, through to when it starts to make its way into pop culture, which like there's a 1928 film called White Zombie, which is, you know, very early black and white film. And then with like George Romero and the 1968, when Night of the Living Dead happened. And then from there, it just explodes. You're living in a time when it's so, so popular. One of the reasons that the theater that sort of supported the development of the play up in Maine I pitched it to them when I'd had the idea. They were like, yes, yes, yes. One of their reasons was that all the work they do with students, like high school students, all the kids just wanted to do something with zombies. And I think Noam Chomsky got asked about this same question. And he said that he thinks that any time you live in a society where part of the society has its boot on the neck of another part of society, you know somehow fundamentally that there's something wrong. And there is just this vibration of expectation that at some point that part of the population that's got someone's boot on its neck is going to rise up and put things back into balance. And I think we're in that place. We're in that place of, you know, tremendous inequality, lots of people feeling powerless.
This is what, I mean, these are the circumstances of Romeo and Juliet as well, that Noel's talking about. So you can see the parallels between the Verona of Shakespeare's play and contemporary times in terms of socioeconomics. And
if you look at the original White Zombie film, that was during the colonization of Haiti by the U.S.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have this sort of Haitian lore, this sort of like where the zombies came from. It's sort of like cultural history before Romero, any of that sort of modern zombie lore came into play. But even when Romero did the original Night of the Living Dead, that's right at Vietnam. There's a lot of racial segregation and sort of like, you know, just this real kind of thing that was going on, which changed the face of, you know.
I have another theory as well as to why zombies are popular right now and why this thing works. Melody's idea for a sequel to Romeo and Juliet is totally supported by the details of Shakespeare's play with regard to plague, with regard to the way illness traveled in that population and the fears people had about contagion. And I feel like, again, there are parallels today. And we see it obviously in obvious ways in terms of outbreak, which, by the way, happened mostly in poor populations. Right? So, again, there's this social inequality. But we also live in a time when all things viral are so present, where information travels so quickly, and I think there is a general fear that this could actually happen. In the same way that real events actually inspired Melody's play, as strange as that sounds, we hear about it all the time. If someone is sick enough and they get on a plane, we know that it's the whole world within 48 hours. Which is why there's all these films and television. It's everywhere now. It has spread. The zombie idea, the zombie culture has spread like a virus.
And people, you know, I think over over history, man is, as in Shakespeare, sort of intrigued or obsessed by death. By what it means to die. And is sort of the finality of that, and I think we struggle with it mm-hmm. right, consistently. So like the sort of like, all of these theories add up to like mm-hmm.
right.
it's a zombie renaissance.
Yeah.
yeah. Was it hard to bring the play to New York? Because I know you were thinking about it when last summer.
Well, we had such a marvelous experience up in Maine. The cast, our director, our design team. Like, it was just a really powerful bonding event.
Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was fun to take the first crack at it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a huge play, because I start with Shakespeare's Act 5. Like, in the end of his play, everybody shows up,
mm-hmm.
right? All the characters. And I really, in approaching the writing, the experiment is that the dead come back to life. So I didn't want to tweak other things. I wanted to stay very true to to Shakespeare's text in the section that becomes the beginning of my play. So I didn't want to write characters out. As a result, I needed to have a ton of actors. And at the theater up there, we were able to have an agreement with the Actors Union that allows them to hire local non-professional
mm-hmm.
actors, and they've got a great internship program for young people. So we had a supporting cast there, and I had no thought that we could make it work in
mm-hmm.
New York. But then we came back, and Jay Stephen and I went to see a play like a week within the first week of being back, and he
mm-hmm.
said, "You know, if you want to do it here, my company will produce it."
We actually talked about it in Maine.
We did talk about
it
in Maine.
Opening night.
Yeah.
Because I was
there. We sat in that cafe, and it was sort of a wouldn't it be great if
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. And even at that time, I was thinking
no
it would be too expensive to do this play as a showcase, to do as
mm-hmm.
a piece of indie theater, because it is big. Melody has,
mm-hmm.
been, you know, the dream is big here. As she's saying, she's starting with the end of a Shakespearean tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then going on
mm-hmm.
with supernatural events, right?
And it is impossible. Like, let's be real. Like, it's a difficult producing project to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jay Stephen talked forever about it. But
incredible job.
You know.
Well, you know, what I've been thinking about a lot this week is the fact that there have been many times during this process when it seemed really impossible because it's too big a play to do on a showcase budget, and then even if you're doing it within the showcase budget, it's still a lot of money for a small company
mm-hmm.
to raise. It's expensive to do
mm-hmm.
theater in New York, but it would not happen
mm-hmm.
unless someone swept in from the off-Broadway world. It probably wouldn't happen any other way, and I think that's what I was thinking when we came back from Maine and we talked, and I said, look, we can give this go.
Mm-hmm.
I also felt that there were enough people behind it already because
mm-hmm.
of those early talks
mm-hmm.
in Maine
mm-hmm.
that there would be a way. But here's the thing that I've been thinking all week. There are so many reasons why this is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's too expensive. The union restrictions are too great.
Mm-hmm.
The company is too large. There's no way to coordinate this many schedules.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough time. You're restricted to 5 weeks. But here's the thing. The play is about the impossible. The play is actually about confronting
mm-hmm.
this very thing. And coming up against absolutely insurmountable odds that there's no way you can overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And still creating a world in which you can do that. So every time I think that this can't happen,
mm-hmm.
I think about what Melody's written.
Ah.
And that's exactly why we're doing it.
And, sir, I live in gratitude to these beautiful people who have helped bring the play to life. And I also think that because Jay Stephen is intimately involved in the play, because he's in addition to being a powerful, you know, force bringing the play, the production, to making it in terms of bringing it and making it happen here. He's also a brilliant actor and a part of this core the company, because he is supporting this production through his company, we're able to do work that has complete integrity. Which, you know, if you have some angel investor come in and sort of say, oh, I'll help, I'll give you what you need to make it happen, that's someone who's not involved, who doesn't necessarily come from the same place of love for the show, who's going to want to say, oh, well, no, you should do this or that or whatever. And instead, we have, you know, our team, our captains at the helm, and, it's everything I could have dreamed of.
There's something to be said for producing it.
Well, and that's the point of off-Broadway. That's the point of indie theater, is that you can do that and not be restricted creatively, not be beholden to commercial interests, not have to shape the work around a financial agenda. Because we come in here knowing that it's not gonna make money anyway. You know, that's not the point. The point is creating some really powerful art that inspires people.
And we want people in New York to see it.
And it provides, in this case, a lot of artists the opportunity to learn and grow and share their work with people.
Yeah, I've been joking since the summer about being a job creator, but it's not really a joke.
It's not really a joke.
They might not be really lucrative jobs, but we've created a lot of jobs.
It's true, and as far as indie theater goes, I mean, obviously a Broadway production has hundreds and hundreds of people, but you know, for an indie theater production, this company is like more than 30 people, maybe 40 people. I haven't even stopped to count. There hasn't been time to stop and count it. But, you know, the first show Melody and I worked together on was a cast of four, a director, an assistant director, and three designers. That's normal. that's reasonable. But we decided that we were going to do something risky. And that's the point of doing it at this level, doing it in this community.
And I think also the other thing that was so key was the way that audiences responded in Maine.
It was a huge success.
It was a huge success, and it was revelatory. I mean, you know, like, we really believed in what we were doing, and we thought it was funny and scary and sexy and all these things, right? But you never know how people are going to receive it.
Mm-hmm. We don't know here.
We don't know. How can we ever know?
Yeah.
But people really had such a good time in Maine, and I think that's what changed my mind about from thinking, oh, it would be great, but there's no way to do it in New York, to thinking it's worth it.
The play, really, even people who think they know what they're in for are really surprised by this. By this play, you know, it's scarier than they think. It's funnier than they think. It's sexier than they think. But it's also smarter than they think, because they hear this sort of melding of Shakespeare and zombies, and they think they're getting something that is less complex and less insightful than it really turns out to be.
Yeah, no, even just from this conversation, I already see so many connections to all different struggles and everything. It's amazing. I didn't know what I was getting into.
But that's what's so great about theater. That's why we do it, because you don't know. It's the adventure, right?
I mean, you know, like, a number of us in this company do a lot of Shakespeare. And I love Shakespeare so much. But you know what you're in for.
Yeah.
You know, nobody doesn't know how Romeo and Juliet ends. People have no idea how this play ends. And that allows us to enter into this tantalizing territory where an audience gets to engage with people they know and a story they know, and yet be surprised.
Yeah. It also lets people do that thing. As far as back as I remember it, with Romeo and Juliet, people are always questioning the choices of these characters. There's something about Shakespeare where people go, Juliet, why would you do that? Why did you do that? And this, and having a sequel actually enables people to engage with that, where we actually see the characters go,
What was I thinking? What were we doing? Why did you make that crazy choice to change the course of our lives? Like, now they actually get a chance to deal with that. So, I think that's satisfying for an audience.
Yeah, and I feel like in Shakespeare's time, people were having that same experience because Shakespeare was writing, he was rewriting stories that had been written before. You know, Romeo and Juliet was based on an Italian story. So it's like, I feel like in terms of what Melody's doing is sort of within the history of playwriting in a really cool way. And, you know, I don't see a lot of theater lately, but I did get to see An Octoroon. And that play is in response to Boucicault's 19th century melodrama called The Octoroon. And his play is called An Octoroon. And it's in complete dialogue with that play. And I find that a really interesting place to be, to have a living playwright grapple with another play in history and another playwright. You know, like, I think that's a really cool, to me that excites me as a director, to sort of, not because I'm trying to be a theater historian, but because we're retelling stories all the time, constantly. We do it in television, movies, and we do it with plays, and it's a really fun place to be.
How long is the period of preparations?
We've had rehearsal, or we've had auditions back in January.
You get a maximum of 5 weeks on an Actors' Equity Showcase for rehearsals.
Mm-hmm. But how many hours a week? 30 hours a week?
25.
25 hours a week. Mm-hmm.
12 plus 4 days.
It's 25 for
individual. What kind of math are we doing right now? 4 nights of 4 hours, which is what, 15 hours, plus 12 hours, 26, 28 hours of rehearsal. Right.
Yeah.
And
then a 3-week run.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's fast. But, you know, we learned so much in Maine, and Melody had spent so much time working on this play before that. But there is a whole history behind it.
I mean, we now, as the core cast, the actors who've returned for this second production, were cast initially in 2014, late January or early February, and then we had a week-long workshop that spring with that core group. So we've been in it, and building company bonds and. Mm-hmm. Diving into these characters and the script for some time, and all of that is foundation. Yeah. Like that's one of the reasons that something so impossible is slightly more possible.
What do you think each one of you brings to this play? Like, if you can,
as an actor, playwright, you have a couple of producer, actor.
All of that. Shall we talk about each other?
Yeah. That's the way to do it, I think.
Jay Stephen is level-headed and passionate at the same time, which makes him a really great producer and actor.
Good combination.
Up to that.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Joan and I went to grad school together. We got our MFA together, and I love her.
We have a shorthand.
And when I was first starting to talk to the initial producers in Maine about who should direct, I talked to Jay Stephen because he wrote that play that he was talking about earlier and in which we met. And he's an outrageous genius. Both of these people are outrageous geniuses, and that's what they bring. But aside from that, I said to him, what do you do? Who do I want to look for in terms of finding someone who to direct my play? And he said, well, you want to make sure that it's someone you trust completely, and you feel safe handing your work over to. And I was like, that's Joan. That's Joan. So valuable to have somebody who I respect be beyond words as an artist, who I have no fear of disagreeing with. Because that's an essential part of the process, and it's really I'm not a person who buys into the idea that like conflict makes for good art. I don't like to work that way, but that doesn't mean you won't disagree. Like you just I like to do it in lovingly and respectfully, you know. Like and then you still work through it, and you come to the best solution.
Yeah.
And we can do that. So.
Melody is, I mean, I've known her as an actor forever. And I think it's true about who she is as an artist in general, playwright, actor, whatever we do. I think it's, she has such a willingness to go for, like, to just go for the stars, you know, she doesn't take no. She always says yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why her play is so ambitious and beautiful, because she dreams big. Mm-hmm. And she really dreams big, and she has such a discipline for language. Mm-hmm. As a playwright, I think that's, you know, as an actor too, but I think that discipline and that love of language, which makes her love Shakespeare, but also makes her, you know, her dad was a writer, and she's really smart. She's smarter than me.
Oh,
which I love. She's smarter. She's smarter than me. Smarter. I know this for a fact. But I think, but whatever. It's not. I think you have to be that.
Don't tell them.
I know. I think that as a I don't know. I mean, it's just those that combination of things makes her a play like this possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just no way around it. Like you couldn't have someone who's thinking on a small scale, who's and her love of pop culture, all those things, you know, also, you know, help to contribute to this particular play. But I think her artistry and her vision is just huge. And that's where the play comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're tagging along.
Yeah.
Oh, you know. But we got to get on the bus with her, and I feel really fortunate about that. It's like it's a bus that she created out of her brain.
Well, yeah, but it wouldn't.
Just shut up.
It wouldn't be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is about us talking about you.
Well, I think that Joan and Melody both have a passion for storytelling and a deep respect for stories and the people that tell them. They both love plays, and they love understanding plays and all the layers of plays. I think that's part of what makes Melody not only both a great playwright and a terrific actor. Having acted with her now, she's also incredibly generous to share a stage with, and she's very specific and always surprises me on stage in the most delightful ways. It's all the things that you want in a fellow actor. And I feel like we never stop. Like, I feel like everything that we do, like, there's always more and more and more. And I think that comes from the spirit that Joan is talking about, that Melody sees possibilities. I've said it a couple of times. My partner said it to me first. Melody Bates has some magic. She's in touch with something. And I think that people gather around a production like this and make it possible because they want to touch that.
Also, like, I mean, I think this is, I find this a really cool fact about Melody, besides her dad being a writer, which I think is a big inspiration for her. But also, she, her undergraduate thesis was, can you describe the thesis?
It was about the heroine's journey in Western fairy tales.
Right. So she, myth and fairy tales and heroine's journeys.
Mm-hmm.
Are a big part of who she is, and I think it's reflected in the play with some of the characters that we know of, but also characters that she's created. based on Shakespeare's play. Mm-hmm. That her passion for that journey is like part of what makes the play particularly really exciting and fun. But she has a lot of knowledge about how, even in how she wrote certain scenes. Mm-hmm. Like I keep thinking of that first one, flower line.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a myth creation in a particular line that most of the audience will not get potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some will, but like that is coming out of her her makeup. Genetic, artistic makeup.
Joan is also an actor, and I feel like that's partly
why. And a freakishly brilliant actor.
Why working with her?
I like this interview.
I do too. Like we should just all do this all the time. But Joan is one of the most insightful directors I've ever worked with, and I love the way she challenges us in rehearsal to go deeper in the process. And she's able to do that because she understands the process, and she understands how each actor's process is different.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I work with her, the more I can see how she orchestrates all of that. But I find it really exciting to work with Joan.
Mm-hmm.
I love it when she gets on the stage with us, actually.
I try to do it rarely.
And the thing is, like I told Melody, as a playwright, you know, about trusting a director, Joan is one of those directors that I trust completely.
Mm-hmm.
Completely.
I may be wrong.
But that's okay, because we're working on the thing together.
Right.
So like we can all, it's so collaborative. So.
And I have to say, we should mention the designers because...
It's an incredible team of designers. I don't know what they're doing.
It's
like
no,
they're
I mean,
amazing.
We're all working for no money. These are designers who are professional designers.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. And are doing it because they're interested in the project.
Mm-hmm.
But they also understand their limitations, but they also understand that there's opportunities at every turn. Like, we're finding stuff today.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding stuff, you know, like, we're just working in a very collaborative mode right now, and I think it's a testament to who they are as designers. Because some designers would swoop in and say this is how it is, and whatever, deal with it. You know, but we're all like, it's completely impossible. We're finding a way.
Great designers are storytellers too.
Yes.
And I think that like everyone on this project, playwright, the actors, the director, the designers. That ultimately, what we are individually and collectively, are storytellers.
That's what theater.
That's what it is.
100%. I was saying yesterday, like, I was like, well, you know, there's imperfections in everything we're doing right now because we're not done, like, with teching everything and costume pieces. I was like, we could do this play as is, and it would be a great night of theater.
Yeah.
You know, even if like the sound, lights, and set were not in sync, or what, like I just feel like it wouldn't. Like you know, I feel like that is a testament to how people are working more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single vision. It's like people are sort of their mind is in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing. I think it doesn't always happen. Even when you have like all of the money in the world and all of the like supports and it's that stuff in the end doesn't matter, because I think it's just about who.
Mm-hmm. It's always about the people in the room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Who came up and why with the idea of this short video, Zombies in the Culture 2. I think those videos are so amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of the wonderful actors in our company, Caitlin Johnston, had a good friend who's a terrific filmmaker named Brandon Boudreau, and he told her that he was willing to help us out with making some promotional videos.
Yeah.
And so we got together, we had a meeting in Bryant Park, and sort of brainstormed and came up with a bunch of ideas that we distilled down into the idea of doing this zombies need culture.
He too. Sent a film campaign.
And he and Caitlin worked up an actual treatment. We'd sort of brainstormed a couple of locations, ideas, and then we went out. We did two days of shooting. The first day, myself and Matt Hurley, who also wonderful, plays Romeo. We got done up in zombie attire and makeup, styled by our phenomenal gore and effects designer, Stephanie Cox Williams. And we started up at Lincoln Center and went to Central Park and to the Delacorte and sort of, you know, just were zombies. And they filmed a bunch of great stuff. Brandon's a terrific cameraman, and in addition to being a really gifted filmmaker. And then we did a second day with Jay Steven and Per Jansen. And we went to, like, Broadway and Times Square and Bryant Park and just got such delightful footage. And then Brandon cut them together, and we knew we wanted to do sort of several of the short spots with this kind of, like, quick punchline coming to Zombies Need Culture, too. And then we shot the kind of master video, which is with Joan and Jay Steven, kind of parodying the sort of ad campaigns that are soliciting charitable donations, you know, like ASPCA, or like for the cost of your daily cup of coffee, you could help this child or this whatever, this zombie.
It's hard now in indie theater. Everybody's raising money, you know. We're not for profit companies, and we depend. You know, ticket sales are capped. So we don't recoup much money through ticket sales, so we depend on grants and donations. And at this point, where everyone in the world has an Indiegogo campaign, we sort of had to find a way around saying, please give to our theater company. And Brandon's brilliant idea was, please help the zombies. So we turned it a little bit, and in a way where we're not only poking a little fun at those commercials you see on television, but I think we're also poking a little fun at the not-for-profit arts world, the way that we struggle so much to find funding any way we can. Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, there are a number of us who really love films, right? We really love working on camera in addition to being on stage, and so to get to take some of the ideas that we play with in this play and translate them completely into a different medium and a different sort of a concept with different goals was really fun.
I think we're hitting the streets again this week too. Some of us are going to go out and promote the show.
That would be awesome.
Zombies out there. So maybe we'll have some new video footage. I know I'm doing punk rock zombies.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing that you work in this environment where you still have space and time to have fun.
I mean, if it's not fun, go home. That's another thing that we should say. Like, there's such good humor and there's such good times to be had with this group of people. And we work hard. Like, there's no doubt about that. And it's not always easy work either, but the good times are always there to ground us.
How do you think can we bring theater into more people's lives? Because I feel there are so many possibilities, especially in New York, but people are just not that interested somehow.
I think partly, I feel like it's important, this is going to sound strange, but I think it's important to tell stories about people's lives as they live them, which is strange.
Like this play.
That we're doing this way. But here's the thing. I think that people really deal with socioeconomic pressures. I think that we're a diverse community, especially in New York, where we're dealing with things like race and immigration and sexuality and all of that in a very real way. I think that probably the time for plays about the privileged class is over. And I feel like we need to start making, if we want more people to come to see theater, then we need to start telling their stories. how strange thing is, in some bizarre way, this kind of is their story. Partly because it does tie into the pop culture zeitgeist of zombies, right? Like everyone's watching The Walking Dead and, you know, World War Z and all of this stuff. But I think that there is also something very real about the struggles of two young people from families that hate each other falling in love and having to deal with that and then having to deal with it again. That is accessible to a lot of people. It's just a matter of somehow finding a way to let them know it and overcome this idea that theater is only for a select few.
Yeah.
It's really not. And certainly in Shakespeare's time, theater was for all of the people.
Yeah, the queen to the groundlings.
The queen to the groundlings. And I think that we need to, that we can get there again, but we have to tell stories that are representative of our entire population.
I mean, television is taking over.
It's true.
What theater was for Shakespeare's time. You know, I mean, it is that kind of, there's a lot of debate about what's on TV and who's it for, and you know, but there's a lot, people access television so easily and readily, and the problem with theater is that, you know, you're in a box building on one part of Manhattan, and only so many people are going to take the train to get to that box to see the thing that is for people, right? So it, you know, it is a sign of our times. It's a sign of people's ability to watch a movie on a tiny phone. It has to be a grassroots effort because of that. Because theater will never, ever, I don't think, ever be able to do battle with television. It's a different. It's a different.
But maybe
thing.
It shouldn't. It's a different.
It can't.
It's different. Yeah.
You know. I think people, theater artists struggle with this all the time, and they struggle with who their audience is and figuring out who their audience is, because I certainly don't want to be doing this play for a bunch of donors and people who, you know, have a disregard for zombies or Shakespeare or whatever. You know, like I want people to be excited about it. I think it's, you know, you have to choose your projects wisely. Occasionally there are breakthrough things. The Book of Mormon, right? It's a Broadway show. It was written by some TV guys, you know, but like it's saying something very particular. I haven't seen it, but I, you know, they're just like certain plays that, you know, that hit a nerve.
I also think that we'll see hopefully more and more multilingual work, and that works will be expanded into different languages. I would be fascinated to see what would happen with a translation. I mean, Shakespeare is translated all the time.
Right.
Well, but is that possible?
I'll say, I don't think anybody, you don't deserve an audience. You know, you don't, just because you work hard on something and you make it doesn't mean you deserve an audience. And I am certainly,
think about visual artists, right?
Yeah.
I'm a populist as an artist. Like, I want to make work that is for the audience. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to make something I don't love. It's always going to be something I love. But I think that there are, in the history of theater in our time in this country, like, you definitely have, you have some artists who are like, have a little bit of disdain for the general population and think, oh, well, they won't understand my work anyway or whatever. And then on the other side, you have people who just pander, who, you know, just like make really stupid, cynical choices in their product because they think, oh, well, that's a guarantee, that's going to get 14 to 25 year old males in the seats, you know, and like, and neither one of those choices is a good path, not for me. I want to earn my audience.
Here's the thing, we know that a small town on the coast of Maine, full of fishermen, will come and see a verse play sequel to Shakespeare, right? So in a way, I think that there just needs to be more of it.
And the regional theater movement in the 60s, you know, was that effort. But regional theaters have become, the ticket prices are astronomical.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to feel like they have access to that now. The idea behind it was great. Mm-hmm. But we're sort of in a different, and you see certain theaters trying to bridge that gap where, and I'm talking about institutional theaters, mm-hmm. right? Like places that now are bringing in young companies and they're trying to, like, you know, yeah, bridge gaps,
mm-hmm.
because there are
mm-hmm.
many gaps. New York theater is a very different thing. Like, yes, we had the ability to corner a market because there is no other market in Maine on this island. Everybody comes to that theater. That's
right.
The theater. They go there to watch movies, and they go there to see plays.
Yeah.
And not everybody goes there to see plays, but if they get wind of something that's really fun or cool, they'll come. You know, because they can. They'll go. And they make it accessible in terms of how island students get in for free.
Mm-hmm.
There's discounts for families who can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yeah, in New York, it's a different monster. Everybody's trying to be seen. Everyone's, you know, not that that's our goal here, but like, you know, at the very least, we know we want our friends to see it. So
I want my enemies to see it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have enemies. I don't think I have any enemies. But
yeah. But you know, it's we all live, most of us live here, or we all live here, so we want to do it in our hometown.
Yeah.
Just that our hometown happens to be New York.
Yeah.
So,
it's good, it's a good time. Like, this show is a good time. That's what we learned last summer, and what we hope will happen here, too.
It's very funny. I hope you might stick around and see the scene that we're about to go into. It's a lot of fun.
Do you know this is the story that I'm going to do after that?
Yeah.
I mean, most people do that. I was going to ask that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, I think most people know it well enough, you know, to jump off with
mm-hmm.
this. And even if you don't, there's so much, it's still delightful. All of the characters in Melody's play take an interesting turn from
mm-hmm.
who they are in Shakespeare's version. But you don't even have to know that much about who they are to enjoy that. You
mm-hmm.
see it happen. She sets it all up pretty well. Yeah.
He's our fight director.
Yeah.
Are you Dan Lincoln?
The fights in this production are extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And only the correct people die.
Dangerous. Danger, Dan.
And after that, we still get to keep them. That's
amazing.